The expectations of education are pretty straightforward in society. You go to school, you learn, you graduate. Boom. Well, easy to say in a few seconds, never that easy when spread across a decade and a half or more. Lots of issues crop up on the way to someone completing an education, and the issues are just that much trickier with issues like learning disabilities or attention deficit disorder with hyperactivity, ADHD, and LD. Today's guest can tell that story from a first-person perspective. Jonathan Mooney is an author and activist. He'll visit Medford next week, next Thursday, to be the keynote speaker at a conference on reframing LD and ADHD. Jonathan Mooney overcame those to graduate from Brown University with an honors degree in English literature. He's the author of the books The Short Bus and Learning Outside the Lines, and is founder and president of Project Eye to Eye, a mentoring and advocacy nonprofit for students with learning differences. Jonathan, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, so excited to be a part of it. Thanks for having me.
So you did not master reading, it sounds like, until age 12. So how did you and school get along up until that point?
Yeah, we weren't friends. You know, I was the kid who really struggled. I spent a lot of the day chilling out with the janitor in the hallway. You know, was on a first name basis with Shirley, the receptionist in the principal's office, and spent a lot of time hiding in the bathroom to escape reading class, and particularly to escape reading out loud. And generally left my educational experience, not all of it, but some of it, kind of feeling like I was the stupid, crazy, lazy kid.
Did anybody ever actually use those words on you? I know in the past four decades or so, we've been a little more careful on using such terms.
Well, I mean, I had a lot of different labels in my educational journey. You know, I was at first certainly considered the sort of disruptive bad kid, whether anyone used that word in particular. That was the undertone. You know, I heard "What's your problem?" quite a lot growing up. No one ever directly called me stupid, but, you know, they didn't have to. You know, at a very early age, I think we confuse or conflate reading with intelligence, and you quickly find yourself in the stupid group. They don't call it that. You know, it's the blackbirds or the bluebirds or the sparrows, but everyone knows. You know, when I was growing up, everybody knew that my group was the stupid group, you know, because it was a bird that didn't fly, you know. Like, it was the ostrich and it ran quickly, you know. So, you know, we subtly disguise these things, but young folks sort of who are different know that, and unfortunately, it doesn't have a very positive connotation.
You know, as I was reading through some of your material, it occurred to me that you're talking about, and just in the experience you talked about a few moments ago, the fact that you spent a lot of time getting to know the janitor and the receptionist, that kids still get sent to the same places. That has really not changed much over time.
No, it hasn't. You know, the idea that the good kid is the compliant kid, which is a deeply held sort of cultural and institutional norm, that hasn't changed. The idea that the smart kid is the kid who reads and does school well, that hasn't changed, though we know from decades of research around human development, multiple intelligences, that intelligence is not one thing but many things. So there's some core experiences within education that haven't changed. And then subsequently, there's a sense of demoralization and of being less than when you don't fit those sort of narrow definitions of what a normal learner means.
Jonathan, what did you need then that you did not get?
Well, I think a few things. You know, on the issue my experience being called the bad kid, you know, there's a fairly simple solution to that. A lot of the origin early in my education of feeling like I was the problem student came from, you know, my relationship with the school desk. You know, I didn't sit still well. So 5 seconds in the class, you know, the foot would start bouncing, you know, 10 seconds, both feet, 15 seconds, you know, I'm the kid rocking the drums, you know, 15 minutes, I'm the kid trying to take his leg and put it behind his neck, you know. And I was shamed for that. I had a teacher in second grade named Mrs. C. You know, I've had many, many brilliant, gifted teachers in my life. Mrs. C wasn't one of those. She would stop class and sort of point at me and say, "What's your problem?" Well, we know that kids like me aren't moving to be disrespectful or disruptive. You know, we know from now decades of research on neuroscience that movement is intrinsically linked to learning. So for me, a class classroom that is active in its nature, that facilitates kids learning through movement, through active engagement, would help me absolutely, but it would have helped every student, because we know that human beings are active learners in their nature. So that was one very sort of doable thing that would have helped me, and then I advocate for others.
So are we barking up the wrong tree, just thinking that we can put kids in desks and have them sit for long periods and have them absorb learning that way?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, came across a statistic recently that about 85% of the school day in American elementary schools now is spent with kids sitting still. The average number of recess minutes in American elementary schools is 14 and a half. And then the number one punishment if you can't sit still for 85% of the day for kids is to lose their 14 and a half minutes of recess. When we think about sort of reimagining education for the 21st century, building active learning environments, starting with the desk and not sitting still, but then going further than that, not thinking about young people as sort of passive vessels to be filled up, but as sort of active agents in their own education and their own construction of knowledge, that's really the future.
Jonathan Mooney is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, author and activist. He's coming to Medford next week for a conference on reframing LD-ADHD next Thursday, 9 to noon at the, I think it's the Higher Education Center in Medford. Medford Library, sorry. So right next to the Higher Education Center in Medford. You can join us now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Bill and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Wow, I really appreciate you guys having him on. I have had all the three problems that he discussed my whole life. I currently read as fast as a sixth grader, but I'm able to be retired because I found my niche in society that doesn't seem to exist anymore. And I'd like to ask his opinion on a couple subjects. One being, I believe the whole education system is wrong in that it's all just pushing college prep, which I fell into. I took the hardest courses all through school, you know, Latin, 2 years of Spanish, physics, algebra. And when you read as fast as a sixth grader, it's a living hell. And I was always looked at as the dumbest kid in the class. And the teachers told my parents I was smart, but I wasn't trying. And basically, the system problem I see with the whole school system were nothing but college mills. We prep kids for college, no job experience, no job training. Then they go to college, spend their $40,000 to $80,000, and they get out, and they don't even like the job if they could find it, which they probably can't find anyway. And I believe in the state of Oregon, 59% of the people don't graduate on time in our high schools. And I think we ought to get back to the old world where during high school, starting in 9th or 10th grade, the kid, if he wants to, goes to some kind of vocational school or internship or apprenticeship on a work site with a company. And when he gets out, he qualifies to fall into an apprenticeship or something, because all kids are not made to go to college. And, you know, everybody thinks that's the only way to succeed in America. And right now in the U.S., there's a lot of companies and factories that are dying to get people that know how to be plumbers, pipefitters, machinists, anything, but they can't fulfill that niche. And I just wonder, in his opinion, speaking to one person that has the same problem I have, but I never conquered reading. I went to all kind of reading clinics, Temple University, Greg Burris, and I did get to go to Temple because my teachers recommended me, and I did better there than I did in high school, but I only took the subject I wanted. But I just liked his opinion on changing the whole education system. It would help everybody, not just the kids with our problems.
All right. Thanks for that, Bill. Appreciate it. Jonathan?
Yeah, well, amen, brother. I mean, in a couple ways. You know, first, the latter point of not reforming the way that we think about school and education moving forward, but reimagining it fundamentally. You know, we have a system that was developed in the 19th century. The core foundations, good kid sitting still, smart kid reading, one teacher, you know, if you're lucky, 25 students, and in urban areas, it's more. You know, that's antiquated and outdated. And we need to think differently about how we build human capacity and potential, both for the kid like me in the hallway, but for all kids. So you were right on and well spoken on that. As it pertains to the issue of higher education in particular, right on as well. Higher education debt is the highest form of personal debt in the country. It eclipsed credit card debt a couple years ago.
Over a trillion dollars now, yeah.
Over $1 trillion for the first time. BAs have the highest unemployment rate in the history of measurement for people with bachelor's degrees. Folks are pressured from an early age in a sort of college or die mentality. And, you know, I know from my personal experience that some of the smartest people I've ever met weren't people who read well or did school well, but they could rebuild the car engine from scratch. They were problem solvers. They had a variety of skills and talents that not only do we need as a culture, but we need economically. As he articulated very well, something like 7 out of the fastest 10 growing professions in America. And this is something we don't talk enough about. 7 out of 10 don't require a bachelor's degree. They require advanced training post-high school. No one disputes that. But it can be contextualized training. It can be an apprenticeship. It can be done in a unique way. Now, I have to say, I'm optimistic about that future. I think, unfortunately, young folks right now are living in a time of dissonance in which the old model is fragmenting and breaking down, and the new model is not yet in place, but there's folks fighting for that. And we are living in a sort of renaissance when it comes to higher education, folks building pathways that may include a BA for those who aspire to it, but include multiple different ways to launch a successful adult life. And I think that's the future.
All right. We're talking to Jonathan Mooney on the Jefferson Exchange. He had, I guess he still does, learning disabilities and ADHD, graduated from Brown University. He's written a couple of books, The Short Bus and Learning Outside the Lines. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange prior to Jonathan's appearance in Medford next week. The phone number here at the Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here is Ryan in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey, and this is awesome. I have to admit that I wish you would have more shows along this line because I think this is really critical in our culture. My individual experience was that I spent much of my time at junior and senior high sitting on the principal's bench, and the women in the office put me to work, so I figured out how to fix all of the machinery, and I got to run the Ditto mimeograph machines. Had a great time hanging out in the office. In fact, it got so silly they eventually were pulling me out of class to come and work there, which I dearly loved because it was experiential, it was driven. We are on the 100th year anniversary of Dewey and experiential education. I think that our metaphors of micromanagement and mathematical analysis of learning outcomes and aesthetic. So I want to champion this. But my one concern in these conversations really is the appreciation that there is a diversity. There's lots of diversities of learners. And we love to label things, and certainly hyperactivity and attention deficit disorder and add in autism spectrum disorders and all of these issues. You know, how do we develop that cultural flexibility to understand that, one, that there's outcomes that we want young people to get to in terms of their own sense of success and capacity and skills that are different, but there's also different learners, different people, different skills, different passions. So, thank you.
All right. Thanks for that. Good to hear from you, Ryan. What do you say, Jonathan?
Well, I think Ryan really nailed it. We as a culture now have a sickness for every human difference, right? When the new version of the Diagnostical Statistical Manual comes out, we've added a whole other category of human beings who now are sick and deserving of treatment. The way I think about it, and I relate to the labels I received, labels of being learning disabled and having attention deficit disorder, is I don't think of myself as somebody who has a disorder or disability. I think of myself as somebody who has a difference that became disabled by the way that the difference was treated. There are many strengths, gifts, and talents that come hand in hand with the brains of folks who have been historically called people with learning disabilities. I'm not naive about the weaknesses of dyslexia, ADHD, that brain, that category, but we don't talk enough about the strength. There's actually research that shows that folks with attentional differences are more entrepreneurial, are good problem solvers. Research study shows that EMTs, emergent medical professionals with that brain, are better at their job than so-called normal EMTs or firemen and women. That makes sense. You know, your house is on fire. You want that dude to have ADD, right? You know, like there's strength there. And so having a nuanced and critical conversation about the way that human difference is being pathologized in the 21st century is a critical advocacy initiative that we all need to be a part of.
I'm struck by something that Bill said a couple of calls ago, where he talked about his own experience where he was accused of being smart but not trying.
Yeah.
And I wondered how we assess that. I mean, I remember hearing, too, you got a good brain, you just need to use it. You know, everybody's probably heard some variation of that. But I mean, how can you truly know when a person is doing what they're capable of doing versus just kind of dogging it because they'd rather be playing video games or something?
Well, it's an interesting thing. I heard lazy a lot in my education, my life, from my father in particular, which is an all too uncommon story. And I've worked with many young people who grow up with that same set of messages, lazy, not applying, et cetera. But one of the things that's interesting, and I heard this in Bill's comment, and I think I also heard it to some extent in Ryan's comment, is that folks who are historically called lazy are people who, when they're following an interest, a passion, are the exact opposite of lazy. You know, there's a difference between being extrinsically motivated, which means you're motivated by things outside of you, you know, reward, punishment, praise. We have an extrinsically motivated education system that tries to indoctrinate folks with the idea of chasing gold stars or avoiding detention, right? And then there's a whole population of people who don't respond to that. They're intrinsically motivated. And I've seen across the country folks wrongly labeled lazy, wrongly labeled folks with attentional problems, that, yes, when they're bored in unstimulating environments, they struggle with motivation. When they're compelled to do something, it's challenging. But when those people are engaged in a task that they care deeply about, something that is autonomous, that they can master, that has a sense of purpose to it, those folks become the opposite of lazy. And I think that's a really practical insight for us to hold on to, practical insight when it comes to reimagining education for the 21st century. The more learners have the capacity to choose, engage, and contextualize interest-driven experiences, to use that concept of experiential education, that's a path forward. And as a human being myself, you know, as I think about living a successful adult life, now I have to stay connected to this idea of intrinsic motivation. I can't fake it till I make it if I don't care about something. I need to carve a life that's about interest and passion. And the more folks I've met with the so-called label of ADD, their life changes when they follow that sense of intrinsic motivation.
Jonathan Mooney will be our guest for the bulk of this hour here on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join our discussion about learning disabilities, ADHD, the things that he has dealt with, and his idea about reframing them. He'll be in Medford next week at the library next Thursday, 9 to noon. He'll be the keynote speaker for a conference about reframing LD-ADHD. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Daniel in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jonathan Mooney.
Yeah, hi. I can really relate to this topic because I've had typewriter leg ever since I've had to sit in class. And so I really appreciate that you want to move towards more experiential and hands-on and kids getting movement. Unfortunately, the national trend is towards trying to keep up with China and trying to get kids to read and do math at much earlier ages. And so I'm curious, since sitting in a chair is a necessary skill, does your book or your lecture address any of the behavioral ways to help kids with ADHD and LD? For example, self-relaxation training is something that has been shown to help kids get more focus. And even though we have so many over-medicated youth these days and kids in college even taking Ritalin so they can stay up and study, I'm wondering if you are aware of any behavioral techniques to help ADHD kids.
All right. Thanks for the question, Daniel. Appreciate it. Jonathan?
Yeah, Daniel, I mean, you mentioned something that plays a big role in my life now, mindfulness, meditation, otherwise known as self-relaxation techniques. We know from peer-reviewed clinical double-blind studies. These have appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine. They've appeared in every reputable scientific journal in the world. We know that a set of behavior interventions can be as effective and then at times more effective than the traditional medication intervention. And those set of interventions are modifying the environment for kids, you know, we talked about the typewriter leg, well said. Ultimate Vision should be an experiential classroom in which people have multiple ways to engage in their learning. But there's a short-term fix, which is, you know, facilitate fidgeting with stress balls. Give young people the opportunity to take breaks. I had a wonderful teacher named Mr. Starkey in high school. Wouldn't be here if it wasn't for this brilliant gentleman. He had a set of clipboards in the back of the room so people could stand in the back and take notes while they were standing up. Those are doable things. So we also know that diet matters. You know, we know that there's some correlation between so-called ADD and gluten and other factors. We also know that behavioral mindfulness meditation, as I mentioned before. So those are all very, very important individual skills parents, individuals, and teachers can bring into their classroom without reimagining the whole thing. But with that said, I do want to hold on to the aspirational vision. You know, there's an interesting paradox, right? Certainly the public-facing rhetoric from Arne Duncan, Secretary of Education, and others is that, you know, we're falling behind Singapore and China, and we need to be more like them. But then the irony is when you listen to folks in that country, in China in particular, when you listen to educational leaders there, they want more of an educational experience like we used to have. They're trying to redesign their system to not have folks who are just rote memorization learners. They're trying to redesign their system around incubating creativity. Because China doesn't want to be the factory of the world. They want to be the designers of the world. And success in a 21st century economy is about being a creative economy. And so I agree that we're on the wrong path when we sort of double down on this 19th century model, and it's going to leave kids behind, communities behind, but it's ultimately going to leave the country behind.
So you're saying we're trying to be more like China when China is trying to be less like China.
What country holds the largest number of patents in the world? We do. You know, what country has had a history of innovation when it comes to breakthrough technologies? We do. We did not have standardized testing and teach to the test model like we have now when we were the most innovative country in the world. We're going backwards, not forwards.
Jonathan Mooney is going to stay with us through the break, so you still have a chance to talk to him on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll take more calls and emails at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org when we come back from the break with Jonathan Mooney and you in a minute 15. It's 8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. You can find us not just on the radio, but also online at jeffexchange.org. There you find our program topics and recordings and a look ahead to future editions of the Jefferson Exchange, all at jeffexchange.org, and also on the larger website that's part of, ijpr.org, with your news and weather and information from our region and around the world. Find us on Facebook. If you like us there, our information will end up on your news feed. If you want to follow us on Twitter, we are at Jeff Exchange. And of course, you can take part in our discussion as it happens. Jonathan Mooney is staying with us. He's our guest, an author and activist who experienced learning disabilities and ADHD himself. Learned to read at age 12, graduated from Brown University with an honors degree in English literature. He now travels the country pushing for changes in the educational system to accommodate people who have some of the issues that he dealt with. He'll be in Medford next week to talk about reframing LDADHD. That'll be next Thursday, 9 to noon at the Medford Library. You can join us now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Vince and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jonathan Mooney.
Yes, I was a counselor for special ed students for over 30 years now, retired here in Eugene. And one of the major issues that I was always dealing with was fighting the administration to get the resources needed, the smaller classroom size, the extra tutoring. And we were able to do that for many years. And then because of budget reasons, all that got cut and disappeared. And I was trying to get to the parents and explain to them that they needed to advocate for those things. I was just be curious to know what the speaker's parents and families were able to do to advocate for them and get the services that he needed.
All right. Good question. Thanks for that, Vince. Jonathan?
Yeah, Vince, you know, wouldn't be here if it wasn't for my mom. That's an important topic for us to have. You know, my mom was a fighter. You know, she was somebody didn't mess with. You know, she was a 4'11 little Irish bulldog. She raised my brother and two sisters on welfare in San Francisco. She had this very high pitched, squeaky voice like Mickey Mouse, and she would curse like a truck driver. And if you were a principal or a teacher, you did not want cursing Mickey Mouse in your office, right? But that's where my mom was. We knew she was there because every dog in the neighborhood was running away, right? Only bats could hear her high-pitched obscenities. My mom was fighting for me. And what she knew, and this is an important message for parents and for committed educators like Vince, and there are so many of them, what she knew was I didn't need somebody in my life to fix me. I needed somebody in my life to fight for my rights to an inclusive education, my rights to an education that valued my differences and addressed those specific needs. And it's cursing Mickey Mouses all around the country. We need more of them to raise their voice for their own kids, but for kids everywhere. He's right about these budget cuts. One of the things that is most interesting and problematic is that if you are a struggling student or a struggling school, under No Child Left Behind, if you become a program improvement school, one of the first things to be cut from your school are often the educational experiences that are most engaging. It's the after-school drama program. It's the experiential robotics club. It's all of those things that, for many young people, it's their haven. It's the only reason that they go to school. Another issue of tremendous cuts, and this has been a theme in our conversation this morning, is cuts to career technical and vocational education. I live in California. Since 2000 to date, the state of California has cut funding for those programs by close to 65%. You know, those programs are often the place where a kid like me or like Bill or many of the callers found a haven for themselves where they had a new identity, not as the stupid kid, but as somebody who had capacities and skills. So advocating for your own child is a path forward for your family. And then all of us raising our voice to advocate for a more learner-centered experience that embraces the continuum of human diversity. You know, that's our work moving forward.
I hear that a lot from the people who say that they're marginal students, or you know, they wouldn't be in school except for X, and X is music or arts or, yeah, or something. And yet those often seem to be the ones where people go, well, these are, you know, not central to the educational mission. Well, for those people, they are.
Yeah. And, you know, I hear a lot of I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for those experiences. And then the other thing that we need to talk honestly and openly about is I hear people who say, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that one teacher. And that is such a critical thing for us to hold on to. You know, we're having a big picture conversation about learning in the 21st century. That feels hard to attain. There's things people can do in the moment. And being a teacher like Vince, who is connected to kids and cares about young people, that makes a big difference. You know, for every one of the Mrs. C's that I had, that I talked about, where I felt demoralized, I had Mr. Rosenbaum, third grade teacher, Mrs. Starkey in high school, her husband, Mr. Starkey, Father Young, who was an educator I had at a pivotal moment in my college experience. You know, I had somebody there who believed in me, connected in me, and while we need to work for long-term change, that short-term intervention matters. And we're having a national conversation that really demoralizes teachers. Spent a lot of time working with educators around the country, and there's a demonization happening that discounts the good work they're doing every day, when what really needs to be demonized is the misguided state and federal policy that has really locked good, committed teachers into a one-size-fit-all classroom experience.
Jonathan Mooney, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, author and activist. We'll be talking about reframing LD-ADHD next week in Medford. You can join them now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Let's get to the teacher, though, because the question I have there concerns how we accommodate people who learn differently and at the same time be able to get the average kids taught at the same time. I mean, from talking to enough teachers over the years about the issues they've had with kids who couldn't stay in their seat or just were disruptive. I mean, they're trying to teach 28 other kids, and the one or the two are making it hard for that to happen. So how do we make it so that both of those things, all those people can learn?
Well, let's name a few important issues on that question. First of all, teachers across the country are not prepared by their own educational experience to differentiate instruction. If you look at the sort of core requirements of teacher education programs nationally, obviously there are exceptions to that. I spoke at the University of Oregon some time ago, and they're one of the shining bright light exceptions of doing it differently. But on a national level, teachers will receive inadequate instruction when it comes to pedagogy, first of all, just how do you engage young people, differentiated pedagogy, which is how do you work with a continuum of different folks, and third, special learning needs. Folks get maybe one class, if they're lucky, on all three of those huge issues. So teachers are set up to fail by their own education. And that's something that we can change at a policy level when it comes to teacher certification requirements. Now, that's not something that individual teachers can change tomorrow, but there are some very, very specific due difference that teachers can put into place. I articulated at the beginning of our conversation the win-win experience on creating a more active in classroom, right? Absolutely. That young person who's rocking their leg or busting out the drums can be a disruption. But when we do manageable, reasonable, cost-effective accommodations for that young person, that disruption is mitigated. Now, the reality is we shouldn't just offer those accommodations to that young person who may have the label, because we're all on a continuum of active learning. You know, I'm on one end of the extreme. Some folks are on the other end, but most of us are in the middle who would benefit from a specific intervention around that. What we know about the literature on inclusion, and this is inclusion for young people like me, and this is inclusion for folks who have more significant and profound cognitive and physical differences. What we know is that inclusion lifts all boats. Everyone benefits from a focus on individual needs.
Jonathan, I haven't had a chance to ask you yet about the short bus, your book, which came from an actual journey. You turned the whole derogatory term of the short bus on its head and actually took a short bus on a tour. Is that what happened?
I did. For those listeners who don't know it, the short bus is an infamous symbol of special education. Kids who grow up in that system, not all, but unfortunately many, go to school on a short bus. Other kids go on the big bus. They roll to school on the short bus. It's a symbol of being separate and not equal. It's one of the last sort of forms of federally funded segregated transportation in the country. And so I wanted to, as you said, subvert what had been a derogatory term. Drove around the country for about 5 months, 45,000 miles, 48 states. And I explored through other people's personal narratives how the idea of being abnormal impacted their life and how they resisted that label of being less than, and how they carved out a meaningful life, not despite their differences, but they carved out a meaningful life because of their differences.
And they, so what were the keys for some of them? I mean, what finally made a difference for them? And it sounds like for you, I was going to ask you if there was one breakthrough teacher. It sounds like there were several, but was it teachers for them? Was it circumstances, a combination thereof?
I think the themes that run through the success of anyone who was in the hallway or grew up demoralized because of a difference are, first of all, people who invested in a positive self-concept for them. We know that self-concept often matters more than skill set. I don't read well to this day. I don't spell well. I spell at a third grade level. You know, I have the attention span of a gnat. But what really helped me was not feeling stupid, crazy, lazy. And investing in that as a parent, as an educator, as a social support provider is always a foundation of change. The other thing you hear is you hear people who did have advocates in their life and meaningful adults like my mom, like Father Young, and others who connected and empowered them. And the third thing you hear is that people who go off to thrive are folks who don't focus on what they can't do. They focus on what they can do. And they define themselves through that asset-based lens. They celebrate those strengths, and they accommodate the weaknesses. And they build a life and then ultimately a sense of self as people who have strengths, gifts, and talents and are valuable in the world.
Have we learned anything, you think, in since your time in elementary school, for example, of how best to deal with people with learning disabilities and ADD?
We know the path forward. If you talk to individuals with the experience, we know the path forward. Parents know the path forward, and frankly, educators know the path forward. The problem is we haven't learned from that knowledge. We haven't built a system and an educational experience that embraces that knowledge. But the good news is No Child Left Behind is being amended and reauthorized as we speak. An emphasis on a sort of test-based educational experience is being de-emphasized, not as much as advocates like myself would like, but nonetheless, it's moving in the right direction. A broad coalition of people say enough is enough. It could be folks with learning differences, could be gifted folks. It's the Chamber of Commerce saying to be competitive in the 21st century, we need creative problem solvers, people who ask the right questions and not just memorize the right answers. So that coalition is driving change, and I'm optimistic that we can build a system of education for the 21st century if we keep fighting for it.
Are we working for the wrong things, though, do you think, Jonathan, in the sense that we're trying to make sure that we raise test scores, make all students good at science, technology, engineering, and math, and don't realize that perhaps working with the LD, ADHD students might be a pathway to get everybody up?
Absolutely. And I think that we are in a shift from an educational system that focused on sort of reading, writing, arithmetic, and content as our core skills, to a system that is looking or should look to build creative thinking, should build intrinsic motivation, and should build non-cognitive skills or character traits like resiliency and perseverance. Again, that's good for me, absolutely. It's good for the kid next to me, but ultimately, as we try to think about what we're aspiring to as a country, you know, what kind of human beings we want to tackle the major problems that we need tackling, from economic inequality to the devastating effects of climate change, those are the type of cognitive skills that will move us forward. And the innovative teachers out there know that and are working hard to change that, but they're working within an antiquated systemic model that needs to change for us to build that future.
I noticed the use of the term neurodiversity. Is that a term you coined?
It's not a term I coined. Neurodiversity has been around for a while. It's a fundamental reframing of these things that have been pathologized and considered deficits and disorders to a part of the human continuum of difference. And we know that populations with the broadest continuum of traits and assets are the strongest populations. And we have to resist a narrowing of what we consider to be a normal human being and the pathologizing and medicating of that. I've learned one thing from the short bus and from my, you know, 15 years of working with young folks who struggle. If I've learned one thing, it's that the only normal people are people you don't know very well. It's not a way to build an individual life, and it's not a way to build a thriving community or culture.
Just a few seconds left. Can you give us a brief idea of what you do with Project Eye to Eye?
Give young folks hope for their future. You know, when I was 12, I had a plan for suicide. What saved my life was a videotape my mother showed me. The videotape was an interview with a young man who went to college, Yale Law School, in fact, but he couldn't read a word. And his mom read every one of his law books to him. That image gave me hope. Now, sucks to be the guy's mom, right? But mom wasn't my concern. I saw an image of a positive future, you know, eye to eye, which was co-founded at Brown with a number of other Brown students, run by a good friend of mine right now, one of the original mentors, co-founder named David Fwing. Eye to Eye is out there every day, all around the nation, trying to give folks like me and Bill and Vince and all the folks who called in a message that they're not broken and that they're valuable because of their differences.
All right. Jonathan Mooney will be at the GIFT LDADHD Reframed Conference at the Medford Library next Thursday, April 23rd, 9 to noon, free and open to the public. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.